noble troops? Plenty, Diamond said. Sparks, but he looks nervous. He didn't glance at us, but he fidgeted and looked as if he might be sweating. For a man who dealt in the underground weapons trade, he certainly seemed bad at handling stress. Diamond glanced from the woman toward Nightwielder, whose hands were clasped behind his back. According to my notes, he rarely spoke directly during business interactions. He preferred to use minions. It was some kind of Japanese culture thing. The conversation continued, and Nightwielder continued to stand straight-backed and silent. They didn't go look at the guns on the walls, even when Diamond hinted that they could. They made him bring the weapons to them, and one of the assistants always handled the inspection and the questions. That's pretty handy, I thought, a bead of nervous sweat dripping down my temple. He can focus on Diamond, study and think without bothering to make conversation. Got it, Megan whispered. I glanced back to see her twisting her mobile around, her hand shading its light to show Abraham the map Tia had sent. Abraham had to lean in close to make anything out. She had the mobile's screen dimmed almost to black. He grunted softly.
7 feet straight back, a few degrees down. That's going to take a few minutes.
You should get at it then, Megan said.
I need your help to pile out the dust.
Megan shuffled to the side and Abraham placed his hands against the back wall near the ground and engaged the tensor. A large disc of steel began to disintegrate beneath his touch, creating a tunnel we could crawl through. Megan began scooping up and moving the steel dust as Abraham concentrated. I turned back to watching, trying to breathe as quietly as possible. The tensors didn't make much noise, just a soft buzzing. Hopefully nobody would notice.
Master thinks that this weapon is of poor quality, the servant said, handing back a machine gun. We are growing disappointed in your selection, merchant.
Well, you want heavy gear but no launchers. That's a difficult prospect to match.
What was in this place on the wall?
A soft, eerie voice asked. It sounded something like a loud whisper, faintly accented, yet piercing. It made me shiver. Diamond stiffened. I shifted the view on the scope slightly. Nightwielder stood beside the wall of weapons. He was pointing toward an open space where hooks jutted from the wall, where the Gauss gun had been.
There was something here, was there not?
Nightwielder asked. He almost never spoke to someone directly like this. It didn't seem to be a good sign.
You only open today. You have already had business?
I don't discuss other clients, Diamond said. You know this.
Nightwielder looked back at the wall. At that moment, Megan bumped a box as she was moving steel dust. It didn't make a loud noise. In fact, she didn't even seem to notice she'd done it. But Nightwielder swiveled his head in our direction. Diamond followed his gaze. The weapons merchant looked so nervous you could have turned milk into butter by sticking his hand in it.
He's noticed us, I said softly.
What?
Abraham said, still concentrating.
Just keep at it, I said, standing. And stay quiet.
It was time for a little more improvising. 18. I shouldered Abraham's gun, ignoring Megan's soft curse. I trotted out from behind the boxes before she could restrain me, and at the last moment, I remembered to pop the earpiece out of my ear and stow it. As I left the shadows, Nightwielder's soldiers trained guns on me with quick motions. I felt a spike of anxiety, the prickling sensation of defenselessness. I hate it when people point guns at me, though I guess that makes me like pretty much everyone else. I continued on. Boss, I called, patting the weapon. I got it working. Magazine comes out easily now. Nightwielder's soldiers glanced toward him, as if looking for permission to shoot. The epic clasped his hands behind his back, studying me with ethereal eyes. He didn't seem to notice, but his elbow brushed the wall and passed right through the solid steel. He studied me, but remained motionless. The goons didn't shoot. Good sign. Come on, Diamond, I thought, trying to contain my nervousness. Don't be an idiot. Say something.
Was it the release pin? Diamond asked.
No, sir, I said. The magazine was bent slightly on one side. I gave a respectful nod to Nightwielder and his flunkies, then moved over to set the gun in the spot on the wall. It fit, fortunately. I'd guessed it would, considering it was close to the same size as the Gauss gun.
Well, Diamond, Nightwielder's female attendant said. Perhaps you can tell us of this new edition. It looks like it.
No, Nightwielder said softly. I will hear it from the boy.
I froze, then turned around, nervous.
Sir?
Tell me about this gun, Nightwielder said.
The boy's a new hire, Diamond said. He doesn't...
It's all right, boss, I said. That's a Manchester 451. The weapon is a powerhouse, 50 caliber, with electron-compressed magazines. Each holds 800 rounds. The select fire system supports single-shot, burst, and full auto capabilities. It has gravitonic recoil reduction for shoulder firing, with optional advanced magnitude scope, including audio receiving, range finding, and a remote firing mechanism. It also includes the optional grenade launcher. Equipped rounds are armor-piercing incendiary, sir. You couldn't ask for a better gun. Nightwielder nodded.
And this,
he said, pointing to the gun next to it. My palms were sweating. I shoved them in my pockets. I knew. Browning M3919, sir. An inferior gun, but very good for the price. Also 50 caliber, but without the recoil suppression and gravitonics, or the electron compression. It is excellent as a mounted weapon, with the advanced heat sinks on the barrel. It can fire around 800 rounds a minute, over a mile effective range with remarkable accuracy. The corridor fell still. Nightwielder regarded the gun, then turned to his minions and made a curt gesture. That nearly made me jump with alarm, but the others seemed to relax. I'd passed Nightwielder's test, apparently.
We will want to see the Manchester, the woman said. This is exactly what we are looking for. You should have mentioned it earlier.
I was embarrassed about the magazine sticking, Diamond said. It's a known problem with Manchesters, I'm afraid. Every gun has its quirks. I've heard that if you file down one of the top edges of the magazine, it slides much more easily. Here, let me get that back down for you. The conversation continued, but I was forgotten. I was able to step back to where I wouldn't be in the way. Should I try to slip away? I wondered. It would seem suspicious if I went to the back of the hallway again, wouldn't it? Sparks. It looked like they were going to buy Abraham's gun. I hoped he'd forgive me for that. If Abraham and Megan got out through the hole, I could just wait here until Nightwielder left, then meet up with them. Staying put seemed like the best move for the moment. I found myself staring at Nightwielder's back as his minions continued negotiations. I was, what, 3 steps away from him? One of Steelheart's 3 most trusted, one of the most powerful living epics. He was right there, and I couldn't touch him. Well, I couldn't touch him literally, since he was incorporeal, but I meant figuratively, too. That was the way it had always been, ever since Calamity appeared. So few dared resist the epics. I'd watched children be murdered in front of their parents, with nobody brave enough to lift a hand to try to stop it. Why would they try? They'd just be killed. He did it to me, too, to an extent. I was here with him. But all I wanted to do was escape. You make us all selfish, I thought at Nightwielder. That's why I hate you, all of you. But Steelheart most of all.
Could use some better forensic tools,
Nightwielder's female minion said.
I realize it's not your specialty.
I always bring some along to New Cargo, Diamond replied. Just for you. Here, let me show you what I have.
I blinked. They were done with the conversation about the Manchester, and apparently they'd bought it and ordered a shipment of 300 more from Diamond, who'd happily made the sale, even though this one wasn't his to sell. Forensics, I thought. Something about that itched at my memory. Diamond waddled over to rummage under his desk for a few boxes. He noticed me and waved me away.
You can go back to the stockpile and continue your inventory, kid. I don't need you here any longer.
I should probably have done as he said, but I did something stupid instead.
I'm almost finished with that, boss, I said. I'd like to stay if I can. I still don't know a lot about the forensic equipment.
He stopped, studying me, and I tried my best to look innocent, hands stuffed in the pockets of my jacket. A little voice in my head was muttering, "You are so stupid, you are so stupid, you are so stupid." But when was I going to get a chance like this again? Forensic equipment would include the kinds of things one used for studying a crime scene, and I knew a little more about that sort of thing than I'd just implied to Diamond. I'd read about it, at least. And I remembered that you could find DNA and fingerprints by shining UV light on them. UV light. The very thing my notes claimed was Nightwielder's weakness.
Fine, Diamond went back to rummaging. Just stay out of the Great One's way.
I took a few steps back and kept my eyes down. Nightwielder paid me no heed, and his minions stood with arms crossed as Diamond got out an array of boxes. He began asking what they needed, and I could soon tell from their responses that someone in the New Cargo government, Nightwielder, maybe Steelheart himself, was troubled by Fortuity's assassination. They wanted equipment to detect epics. Diamond didn't have such a thing. He said he'd heard of some for sale in Denver, but it had turned out to be only a rumor. It appeared that dowsers, like the Reckoners had, weren't easy to come by even for someone like Diamond. They also wanted equipment to better determine the origins of bullet shells and explosives. This request he could accommodate, particularly tracking down explosives. He unpacked several devices from their styrofoam and cardboard, then showed a scanner that identified the chemicals in an explosive by analyzing the ash produced. I waited. Tense, as one of the minions picked up something that looked like a metal briefcase with locks on the sides. She flipped it open, revealing a bunch of smaller devices situated in foam holes. That looked just like the forensic kits I'd read about. A small data chip was attached to the top, glowing faintly now that the case was open. That would be the manual. The minion waved her mobile in front of it absently, downloading the instructions. I stepped over and did likewise. And though she glanced at me, she soon dismissed me and turned back to her inspection. My heart beating more quickly, I scanned through the manual's contents until I found it. UV fingerprint scanner with attached video camera. I skimmed the instructions. Now, if I could just get it out of the case. The woman took out a device and inspected it. It wasn't the fingerprint scanner, so I didn't pay attention. I snatched that scanner the second she looked away, and then I pretended to just be fiddling with it, trying my best to look idly curious. In the process, I got it turned on. It glowed blue at the front and had a screen on the back. It worked like a digital camcorder, but with a UV light on the front. You shined the light over objects and recorded images of what that revealed. That would be handy if doing a sweep of a room for DNA. It would give you a record of what you'd seen. I turned on the record function. What I was about to do could easily get me killed. I'd seen men murdered for far less, but I knew Tia wanted stronger proof. It was time to get her some. I turned the UV light and shined it on Nightwielder. 19. Nightwielder spun on me immediately. I turned the UV light to the side, my head down, as if I were studying the device and trying to figure out how it worked.
I wanted it to seem like I'd shined the light on him by happenstance while fiddling with it. I didn't look at Nightwielder. I couldn't look at Nightwielder. I didn't know if the light had worked on him, but if it had, and he so much as suspected that I'd seen, I'd die. I might die anyway. It was painful not to know what effect the light had produced, but the device was recording. I turned away from Nightwielder, and with one hand I tapped some buttons on the device as if trying to make it work. With the other, fingers trembling nervously, I slid out the data chip and hid it in the palm of my hand. Nightwielder was still watching me. I could feel his eyes, as if they were drilling holes into my back. The room seemed to grow darker, shadows lengthening. To the side, Diamond continued chatting about the features of the device he was demonstrating. Nobody seemed to have noticed that I'd drawn Nightwielder's attention. I pretended not to notice either, though my heart was pounding even harder in my chest. I fiddled with the machine some more, then held it up as if I'd finally figured out how it worked. I stepped forward and pressed my thumb on the wall, then stepped back to try to see the thumbprint show up in the UV light. Nightwielder hadn't moved. He was considering what to do. Killing me would protect him if I'd noticed what the UV light did. He could do it. He could claim that I'd impinged on his personal space or looked at him wrong. Sparks, he didn't even need to give an excuse. He could do what he wanted. However, that could be dangerous for him. When an epic killed erratically or unexpectedly, people always wondered if it was an attempt to hide their weakness. His minions had seen me holding a UV scanner. They might make a connection. And so, to be safe, he'd probably have to kill Diamond and the enforcement soldiers as well. Probably his own assistants, too. I was sweating now. It felt awful to stand there, to not even be facing him as he considered murdering me. I wanted to spin, look him in the eyes, and spit at him as he killed me. Steady, I told myself, keeping the defiance from my face. I looked over and pretended to notice, for the first time, that Nightwielder was staring at me. He stood as he had earlier, hands behind his back, black suit and thin black necktie making him look all lines. Motionless gaze, translucent skin. There was no sign of what had happened, if indeed anything had happened. Upon seeing him, I jumped in shock. I didn't have to feign fear. I felt my skin grow pale, the color drain from my face. I dropped the fingerprint scanner and yelped softly. The scanner cracked as it hit the ground. I immediately cursed, crouching down beside the broken device.
What are you doing, you fool?
Diamond bustled over to me. He didn't seem very worried about the scanner, more about my offending Nightwielder somehow.
I'm so sorry, Great One. He is a bumbling idiot, but he's the best I've been able to find.
Diamond hushed as the shadows nearby lengthened, then swirled upon themselves, becoming thick black cords. He stumbled away and I jumped to my feet. The darkness didn't strike at me, however, but scooped up the fallen fingerprint scanner. The blackness seemed to pool on the floor, writhing and twisting about itself. Tendrils of it raised the scanner up into the air in front of Nightwielder, and he studied it with an indifferent gaze. He looked at us, and then more of the blackness rose up and surrounded the scanner. There was a sudden crunch, like 100 walnuts being cracked at once. The intended message was clear. Annoy me, and you will meet the same fate. Nightwielder neatly obscured his fear of the scanner and his desire to destroy it, behind the guise of a simple threat.
I
said softly.
Boss, why don't I just go to the back and keep working on that inventory like you said?
What you should have done from the first, Diamond said. Off with you.
I turned and scrambled away, hand held to my side, clutching the data chip from the UV scanner. I hurried my pace, not minding how I looked, until I was running. I reached the boxes and the relative safety of their shadows. There, close to the floor, I found a completed tunnel burrowed through the back wall. I lurched to a stop. I took a breath,
got on my hands and knees, and scrambled into the opening. I slid through the 7 feet of steel and came out the other side. Something grabbed my arm, and I pulled back by instinct. I looked up, logic fleeing as I thought of how Nightwielder had made the shadows themselves come alive, but was relieved to see a familiar face.
Hush, Abraham said, holding my arm. Are they chasing?
I don't think so, I said softly.
Where's my gun?
I kind of sold it to Nightwielder. Abraham raised an eyebrow at me, then towed me to the side where Megan covered us with my rifle. She was the definition of professional, lips a terse line, eyes searching the tunnels nearby for danger. The only light came from the mobiles she and Abraham wore strapped to their shoulders. Abraham nodded to her, and there was no further conversation as the three of us made our escape down the corridor. At the next intersection of the catacombs, Megan tossed my rifle to Abraham, ignoring that I'd put my hand out for it, and unholstered one of her handguns. She nodded to him, then took point, hurrying ahead down the steel tunnel. We continued that way, no talk for a time. I'd been hopelessly lost before, but now I was turned around so much I barely knew which direction was up.
Okay,
Abraham finally said, holding up a hand to wave Megan back.
Let's take a breather and see if anyone is following.
He settled down in a small alcove in the hallway where he could watch the stretch behind us and see if anyone had followed. He seemed to be favoring the arm opposite the shoulder that had been shot. I crouched beside him and Megan joined us.
That was an unexpected move you made up there, David,
Abraham said softly, calmly. I didn't have time to think about it, I said. They heard us working.
True, true. And then Diamond suggested you go back, but you said you wanted to stay?
So you heard that?
I could not have just mentioned it if I hadn't.
He continued looking down the hallway. I glanced at Megan, who gave me a frosty stare. Unprofessional, she muttered. I fished in my pocket and brought out the data chip. Abraham glanced at it, then frowned. He obviously hadn't stayed long enough to see what I was doing with Nightwielder. I tapped the chip to my mobile, downloading the information. 3 taps later, it started displaying the video from the UV scanner. Abraham glanced over, and even Megan craned her neck to see what it was showing. I held my breath. I still didn't know for certain if I was right about Nightwielder, and even if I was, there was no telling whether my hasty spin of the scanner had captured any usable images. The video image showed the ground with me waving my hand in front of the lens. Then it turned on Nightwielder, and my heart leaped. I tapped the screen, freezing the image.
You clever little slants,
Abraham muttered. There on the screen, Nightwielder stood with half his body fully corporeal. It was difficult to make out, but it was there. Where the UV light shone, he wasn't translucent, and his body seemed to have settled more. I tapped the screen again, and the UV light panned past, letting Nightwielder become incorporeal again. The video was only a second or two, but it was enough. UV forensic scanner, I explained. I figured this was the best chance we'd get to know for certain. I can't believe you took that chance, Megan said. Without asking anyone, you could have gotten all three of us killed.
But he didn't,
Abraham said, plucking the data chip from my hand. He studied it, seeming oddly reverent. Then he looked up, as if remembering he'd been planning to watch the hallway for signs of people following.
We need to get this chip to Prof, now.
He hesitated.
Nice work.
He stood up to go, and I found myself beaming. Then I turned to Megan, who gave me an even colder, more hostile look than she had earlier. She rose and followed Abraham. Sparks, I thought. What would it take to impress that girl? I shook my head and jogged after them.
20.
When we returned, Cody was off on a mission to do some scouting for Tia. She waved toward some rations on the back table of the main room, awaiting devourment, devouration, and whatever that word is.
Go tell Prof what you found,
Abraham said softly, walking toward the storage room. Megan made her way to the rations. Where are you going? I asked Abraham.
I need a new gun, it seems,
he said with a smile, ducking through the doorway. He hadn't chided me for what I'd done with his gun. He saw that I'd saved the team. At least, I hoped that was how he viewed it. Still, there was a distinct sense of loss in his voice. He'd liked that gun, and it was easy to see why. I'd never owned a weapon as nice as that one. Prof wasn't in the main room, and Tia glanced at me, raising an eyebrow.
What are you telling Prof?
I'll explain, Megan said, sitting down beside her. As usual, Tia had her table covered with papers and cans of cola. It looked like she'd gotten the insurance records Cody mentioned, and she had them up on the screen in front of her. If Prof wasn't in here, I figured he was probably in his thinking room with the imager. I walked over and knocked softly on the wall. The doorway was only draped with a cloth.
Come in, David,
Prof's voice called from inside. I hesitated. I hadn't been in the room since I had told the team my plan. The others rarely entered. This was Prof's sanctum, and he usually came out, rather than inviting people in, when they needed to speak to him. I glanced at Tia and Megan, both of whom looked surprised, though neither said anything. I pushed past the cloth and stepped into the room. I'd imagined what Prof was doing with the wall imagers, maybe exploiting the team's hack of the spy network, moving through the city and studying Steelheart and his minions. It wasn't anything so dramatic. Chalkboards? I asked. Prof turned from the far wall where he'd been standing and writing with a piece of chalk. All four walls, along with ceiling and floor, had been turned slate black, and they were covered in white scribbled writing.
I know, Prof said, waving me in. It's not very modern, is it? I have technology capable of representing just about anything I want, in any form I want, and I choose chalkboards.
He shook his head, as if in amusement at his own eccentricity.
I think best this way. Old habits, I guess.
I stepped up to him. I could see now that he wasn't actually writing on the walls. The thing in Prof's hand was just a little stylus shaped like a piece of chalk. The machine was interpreting his writings, making the words appear on the wall as he scribbled them. The drape had fallen back into place, masking the light from the other rooms. I could barely make Prof out. The only light came from the soft glow of the white script on all six walls. I felt as if I were floating in space, the words stars and galaxies shining at me from distant abodes. What is this? I asked, looking upward, reading the script that covered the ceiling. Prof had certain bits of it boxed away from others, and had arrows and lines pointing to different sections. I couldn't make much sense of what it said. It was written in English, kind of, but many of the words were very small and seemed to be in some kind of shorthand.
The plan,
Prof said absently. He didn't wear his goggles or coat. Both sat in a pile beside the door, and the sleeves of his black button-up shirt were rolled to the elbows. My plan? I asked. Prof's smile was lit by the pale glowing chalk lines.
Not any longer. There are some seeds of it here, though.
I felt a sharp sinking feeling. But, I mean, Prof glanced at me, then laid a hand on my shoulder.
You did a great job, son, all things considered.
What was wrong with it? I asked. I'd spent years, really my entire life, on that plan, and I was pretty confident in what I'd come up with.
Nothing, nothing, Prof said. The ideas are sound, remarkably so. Convince Steelheart that there's a rival in town. Lure him out, hit him. Though there is the glaring fact that you don't know what his weakness is.
Well, there is that, I admitted. Tia is working hard on it. If anyone can tease out the truth, it will be her,
Prof said, then paused for a moment before he continued.
Actually, no. I shouldn't have said that this isn't your plan. It is. And there are more than just seeds of it here. I looked through your notebooks. You thought through things very well.
Thank you.
But your vision was too narrow, son.
Prof moved his hand from my shoulder and walked up to the wall. He tapped it with his imitation chalk stylus, and the room's text rotated. He didn't appear to even notice, but I grew dizzy as the walls seemed to tumble about me, spinning until a new wall of text popped up in front of Prof.
Let me start with this,
he said.
Other than not specifically knowing Steelheart's weakness, what's the biggest flaw in your plan?
I frowned. Taking out Nightwielder, maybe? But, Prof, we just-
Actually,
Prof said,
that's not it.
My frown deepened. I hadn't thought there was a flaw in my plan. I'd worked all those out, smoothing them away like cleanser removing the pimples from a teenager's chin.
Let's break it down,
Prof said, raising his arm and sweeping an opening on the wall, like he was wiping mud from a window. The words scrunched to the side, not vanishing, but bunching up like he'd pulled a new section of paper from a spool. He raised his chalk to the open space and started to write.
Step one, imitate a powerful epic. Step two, start killing Steelheart's important epics to make him worried. Step three, draw him out. Step four, kill him. By doing this, you restore hope to the world and encourage people to fight back.
I nodded.
Except there's a problem,
Prof said, still scribbling on the wall.
If we actually manage to kill Steelheart, we'll have done it by imitating a powerful epic. Everyone's going to assume then that an epic was behind the defeat. And so, what do we gain?
We could announce it was the Reckoners after the fact. Prof shook his head.
Wouldn't work. Nobody would believe us. Not after all the trouble we'll need to go through to make Steelheart believe.
Well, does it matter? I asked. He'll be dead. Then more softly, I added, and I get revenge. Prof hesitated, chalk pausing on the wall.
Yes, he said. I guess you'd still have that.
You want him dead too, I said, stepping up beside him. I know it. I can see it.
I want all epics dead.
It's more than that, I said. I've seen it in you. He glanced at me, and his gaze grew stern.
That doesn't matter. It is vital that people know we were behind this. You said it yourself. We can't kill every epic out there. The Reckoners are spinning in circles. The only hope we have, the only hope that humankind has, is to convince people that we can fight back. For that to happen, Steelheart has to fall by human hands.
But for him to come out, he has to believe an epic is threatening him, I said.
You see the problem?
I was starting to. So we're not going to imitate an epic?
We are, Prof said. I like the idea, the spark of that. I'm just pointing out problems we have to work through. If this limelight is going to kill Steelheart, we need a way to make certain that after the fact, we can convince people it was really us. Not impossible, but it is why I had to work more on the plan. Expand it.
Okay, I said, relaxing. So we were still on track. A false epic, the soul of my plan, was there.
There's a bigger problem, unfortunately,
Prof said, tapping his chalk against the wall.
Your plan calls for us to kill epics in Steelheart's administration to threaten him and draw him out. You indicate that we should do this to prove that a new epic has come to town. Only that's not going to work.
What? Why?
Because it's what the Reckoners would do.
Prof said.
Killing Epics quietly, never coming out into the open? It'll make him suspicious. We need to think like a real rival would. Anyone who wants new cargo would think bigger than that. Any Epic out there can have a city of his own. It's not that hard. To want new cargo, you'd have to be ambitious. You'd have to want to be a king. You'd have to want Epics to your beck and call. And so, killing them off one by one wouldn't make sense, you see?
You'd want them alive so they'd follow you, I said, slowly understanding. Every Epic you kill would lessen your power once you actually took New Cargo.
Exactly,
Prof said.
Nightwielder, Firefight, maybe Conflux. They'll have to go. But you'd be very careful who to kill and who to try to bribe away.
Only we can't bribe them away, I said. We wouldn't be able to convince them that we're an Epic, not long term.
So you see another problem,
Prof said. He was right, I wilted, like soda going flat in a cup left out overnight. How had I not seen this hole in my plan?
I've been working on these two problems,
Prof said.
If we're going to imitate an Epic, and I think we still should, we need to be able to prove that we were behind it all along. That way, the truth can flood New Cargo and spread across the fractured states from there. We can't just kill him. We have to film ourselves doing so, and we need to, at the last minute, send information about our plan to the right people around the city, so that they know and can vouch for us. People like Diamond, non-Epic crime magnates, people with influence but no direct connection to his government.
Okay, but what about the second problem?
We need to hit Steelheart where it hurts,
Prof said.
But we can't spread it out over too much time, and we can't focus on Epics. We need one or two massive hits that make him bleed, make him see us as a threat. And we need to do it as a rival seeking to take his place.
So, Prof tapped the wall, rotating the text from the floor up in front of him. He tapped a section, and some of the text started glowing green. Green? I said, amused. What was that about liking things old-fashioned?
You can use colored chalk on a chalkboard,
he said gruffly, as he circled a pair of words. Sewage system. Sewage system, I said. I'd been expecting something a little more grand and a little less crappy. Prof nodded.
The Reckoners never attack facilities. We focus only on Epics. If we hit one of the city's main points of infrastructure, it will make Steelheart believe it's not the Reckoners working against him, but some other force. Someone specifically trying to take down Steelheart's rule. Either rebels in the city or another Epic moving on his territory. New Cargo works on two principles, fear and stability. The city has the basic infrastructure that many others don't, and that draws people here. The fear of Steelheart keeps them in line.
He rolled the words on the walls again, bringing over a network of drawings he'd done in chalk on the far wall. It looked like a crude blueprint.
If we start attacking his infrastructure, he'll move on us faster than if we'd attacked his Epics. Steelheart is smart. He knows why people come to New Cargo. If he loses the basic things, sewage, power, communications, he'll lose the city.
I nodded slowly. I wonder why.
Why? I just explained.
Prof trailed off, looking at me. He frowned.
That's not what you mean.
I wonder why he cares. Why does he go to so much trouble to create a city where people want to live? Why does he care if they have food or water or electricity? He kills them so callously, yet he also sees that they're provided for. Prof fell silent. Eventually, he shook his head.
What is it to be a king if you have nobody to follow you?
I thought back to that day, the day when my father died. these people are mine. As I considered it, I realized something about the epics, something that, despite all my years of study, I'd never quite understood before.
It isn't enough, Prof whispered. It isn't enough to have godly powers, to be functionally immortal, to be able to bend the elements to your will and soar through the skies. It isn't enough unless you can use it to make others follow you. In a way, the epics would be nothing without the regular people. They need someone to dominate. They need some way to show off their powers.
I hate him, I hissed, though I hadn't meant to say it out loud. I hadn't even realized I'd been thinking it. Prof looked at me.
What?
I asked. Are you going to tell me that my anger doesn't do any good? People had tried to tell me that in the past, Martha foremost among them. She claimed the thirst for vengeance would eat me alive.
Your emotions are your own business, son,
Prof said, turning away.
I don't care why you fight, so long as you do fight. Maybe your anger will burn you away. But better to burn yourself away than to shrivel up beneath Steelheart's thumb.
He paused.
Besides, telling you to stop would be a little like a hearth telling the oven to cool down.
I nodded. He understood. He felt it too.
Regardless, the plan is now realigned,
Prof said.
We'll strike at the wastewater treatment plant, as it's the least well guarded. The trick will be making sure Steelheart connects the attack to a rival epic, rather than just rebels.
Would it be so bad if people thought there was a rebellion?
It wouldn't draw Steelheart out, for one,
Prof said.
And if he thought the people were rebelling, he'd make them pay. I won't have innocents dying in retaliation for things we've done.
But, I mean, isn't that the point? To show the others that we can fight back? Actually, as I think about it, maybe we could set up here in Nukago for good. If we win, maybe we could lead the place once—
Stop.
I frowned.
We kill epics, son,
Prof said, his voice suddenly quiet, intense.
And we're good at it. But don't get it in your mind that we're revolutionaries, that we're going to tear down what's out there and put ourselves in its place. The moment we start to think like that, we derail. We want to make others fight back. We want to inspire them. But we dare not take that power for ourselves. That's the end of it. We're killers. We'll rip Steelheart from his place and find a way to pull his heart from his chest. After that, let someone else decide what to do with the city. I want no part of it.
The ferocity of those words, soft though they were, quieted me. I didn't know how to respond. Maybe Prof did have a point, though. This was about killing Steelheart. We had to stay focused. It still felt odd that he hadn't challenged me on my passion for vengeance. He was pretty much the first person who hadn't served me some platitude on revenge. Fine, I said. But I think the sewage station is the wrong place to hit.
Where would you go?
The power station.
Too well guarded.
Prof examined his notes, and I could see that he had a schematic of the power station as well, with notations around the perimeter. He'd considered it. I got a thrill from the idea that the two of us thought along the same lines. If it's well guarded, I said, then blowing it up will look that much more impressive, and we could steal one of Steelheart's power cells while we're there. We brought back a gun from Diamond, but it's dry. It needs a powerful energy source to run. I raised my mobile to the wall and uploaded the video of the Gauss gun firing. The video appeared on the wall, shoving aside some of Prof's chalk writings, and played. He watched in silence, and when it was done, he nodded.
So our fake epic will have energy powers.
And that's why he'd destroy the power station, I said. It's in theme. Epics liked themes and motifs.
It's too bad that removing the power station wouldn't stop enforcement,
Prof said.
Conflux powers them directly. He powers some of the city directly, too,
but our intel says he does it by charging power cells that are stored here.
He pulled up his schematics of the power station.
One of those cells could power this gun. They're extremely compact, and they each have more juice packed into them than should be physically possible. If we blow the station and the rest of those cells, it will cause serious damage to the city.
He nodded.
I like it. Dangerous, but I like it.
We'll still have to hit Conflux, I said. It would make sense, even for a rival epic. First remove the power station, then take out the police force. Chaos. It will work particularly well if we can kill Conflux using that gun, giving off a big light show. Prof nodded.
I'll need to do more planning, he said, raising a hand and wiping away the video.
It came off like it had been drawn in chalk. He pushed aside another pile of writing and raised his stylus to start working. He stopped, however, then looked at me. What? I asked. He walked over to his Reckoner jacket, which sat on a table, and took something out from under it. He walked back and handed it to me. A glove, one of the tensors.
You've been practicing?
He asked me. I'm not very good yet.
Get better. Fast. I won't have the team underpowered, and Megan can't seem to make the tensors work.
I took the glove, saying nothing, though I wanted to ask the question, why not you, Prof? Why do you refuse to use your own invention? Tia's warning not to pry too much made me hold my tongue. I confronted Nightwielder, I blurted out, only now remembering the reason I'd come to talk with Prof.
What?
He was there, at Diamond's place. I went out and pretended to be one of Diamond's helpers. I used a UV fingerprint scanner he had to confirm Nightwielder's weakness. Prof studied me, his face betraying no emotions.
You've had a busy afternoon. I assume you did this at great risk to the entire team?
Yes. Better he heard it from me rather than Megan, who would undoubtedly report, in great detail, of how I deviated from the plan.
You show promise,
Prof said.
You take risks, you get results. You have proof of what you said about Nightwielder?
I got a recording.
Impressive.
Megan wasn't very happy with it.
Megan liked the way things were before,
Prof said.
Adding a new team member always upends the dynamic. Besides, I think she's worried you're showing her up. She's still smarting from being unable to make the tensors work.
Megan? Worried that I was showing her up? Prof must not know her very well.
Out with you, then,
Prof said.
I want you up to speed with the tensor by the time we hit the power plant, and don't worry too much about Megan.
I won't. Thank you.
Worry about me.
I froze. Prof started writing on the board and didn't turn back when he spoke, but his words were sharp.
You got results by risking the lives of my people. I assume nobody was hurt, otherwise you'd have mentioned it by now. You show promise, as I said. But if you brashly get one of my people killed, David Charleston, Megan will not be your problem. I won't leave enough of you for her to bother with.
I swallowed. My mouth had suddenly gone dry.
I trust you with their lives,
Prof said, still writing.
And them with yours. Don't betray that trust, son. Keep your impulses in check. Don't just act because you can. Act because it's the right thing to do. If you keep that in mind, you'll be all right.
Yes, sir, I said, leaving with a quick step out the cloth-covered doorway. 21.
How's the signal?
Prof asked through the earpiece. I raised my hand to my ear. Good, I said. I wore my mobile, newly tuned to the Reckoner mobiles,
and made completely secure from Steelheart's prying, on my wrist mount. I'd also been given one of the jackets. It looked like a thin black and red sports-style jacket, though it had wiring all around the inside lining and a little power pack sewn into the back. That was the part that would extend a concussion field around me if I was hit hard. Prof had built it for me himself. He said it would protect me from a short fall or a small explosion. But I shouldn't try jumping off any cliffs or getting shot in the face. Not like I was intending to do either. I wore it proudly. I'd never been officially told I was a member of the team. But these two changes seemed essentially the same thing. Of course, going on this mission was probably a good indication, too. I glanced at my mobile. It showed that I was only on the line with Prof. Tapping the screen could move me to a line to everyone in the team, cycle me to a single member, or let me pick a few of them to talk to.
You in position?
Prof asked. We are. I stood in a dark tunnel of pure steel, the only light that of my mobile and Megan's up ahead. She wore a pair of dark jeans and her brown leather jacket, open at the front, over a tight t-shirt. She was inspecting the ceiling. Prof, I said softly, turning away. You sure I can't pair up with Cody for this mission?
Cody and Tia are interference,
Prof said.
We've been over this, son.
Maybe I could go with Abraham then, or you. I glanced over my shoulder, then spoke even more softly. She doesn't really like me much.
I won't have two members of my crew not getting along,
Prof said sternly.
You will learn to work together. Megan is a professional. It'll be fine.
Yes, she's professional, I thought. Too professional. But Prof wasn't hearing any of it. I took a deep breath. Part of my nervousness, I knew, was because of the job. 1 week had passed since my conversation with Prof, and the rest of the Reckoners had agreed that hitting the power station and imitating a rival Epic while doing so was the best plan. Today was the day. We'd sneak in and destroy New Kago's power plant. This would be my first real Reckoner operation. I was finally a member of the team. I didn't want to be the weak one.
You good, son?
Prof asked.
Yeah.
We're moving. Set your timer.
I set my mobile for a 10-minute countdown. Prof and Abraham were going to break in first on the other side of the station, where all the huge equipment was. They'd work their way upward, setting charges. At the 10-minute mark, Megan and I would go in and steal a power cell to use with the Gauss gun. Tia and Cody would come in last, entering through the hole Prof and Abraham had made. They were a support team, ready to move and help us extract if we needed to, but otherwise, hanging back and giving us information and guidance. I took another deep breath. On the hand opposite my mobile, I wore the black leather tensor, with glowing green strips from the fingertips to the palm. Megan eyed me as I strode up to the end of the tunnel that Abraham had dug the day before during a scouting mission. I showed her the countdown.
You're sure you can do this? She asked me.
There was a hint of skepticism in her voice, though her face was impassive.
I've gotten a lot better with the tensors, I said. You forget that I've watched most of your practice sessions.
Cody didn't need those shoes, I said. She raised an eyebrow at me.
I can do it, I said, stepping up to the end of the tunnel where Abraham had left a pillar of steel jutting from the ground. It was short enough that I could step up on it to reach the low ceiling. The clock ticked down. We didn't speak. I mentally sounded out a few ways to start conversation, but each one died on my lips as I opened my mouth. Each time, I was confronted by Megan's glassy stare. She didn't want to chat. She wanted to do the job. Why do I even care? I thought, looking up at the ceiling. Other than that first day, she's never shown me anything other than coldness and the occasional bit of disdain. Yet, there was something about her. More than the fact that she was beautiful, more than the fact that she carried tiny grenades in her top, which I still thought was awesome, by the way. There had been girls at the factory, but like everyone else, They were complacent. They'd just call it living their lives, but they were afraid. Afraid of enforcement, afraid that an epic would kill them. Megan didn't seem afraid of anything, ever. She didn't play games with men, fluttering her eyes, saying things she didn't mean. She did what needed to be done, and she was very good at it. I found that incredibly attractive. I wished I could explain that to her, but getting the words out of my mouth felt like trying to push marbles through a keyhole. I began. My mobile beeped. "Go," she said, looking upward. Trying to tell myself I wasn't relieved by the interruption, I raised my hands up to the ceiling and closed my eyes. I was getting better with the tensor. I still wasn't as good as Abraham, but I wasn't an embarrassment any longer. At least, not most of the time. I pressed my hand flat against the metal ceiling of the tunnel and pushed, holding my hand in place as the vibrations began. The buzzing was like the eager purr of a muscle car that had just been started, but left in neutral. That was another of Cody's metaphors for it. I'd said the sensation felt like an unbalanced washing machine filled with 100 epileptic chimpanzees. Pretty proud of that one. I pushed and kept my hand steady, humming softly to myself in the same tone as the tensor. That helped me focus. The others didn't do it, and they didn't always have to keep their hand pressed against a wall either. I eventually wanted to learn to do it like they did, but this would work for now. The vibrations built, but I contained them, held them in my hand, kept hold of them until it felt like my fingernails were going to rattle free. Then I pulled my hand back and pushed somehow. Imagine holding a swarm of bees in your mouth, then spitting them out and trying to keep them pointed in a single direction by the sheer force of your breath and will. It's kind of like that. My hand flew back, and I launched the half-musical vibrations away into the ceiling, which rattled and shook with a quiet hum. Steel dust fell down around my arm, showering to the ground below like someone had taken a cheese grater to a refrigerator. Megan crossed her arms and watched, a single eyebrow raised. I prepared myself for some cold, indifferent comment. She nodded and said, "Nice work." "Yeah, well, you know, I've been practicing a lot, hitting the old wall vaporizing gym." "The what?" She frowned as she pulled over the ladder we'd brought with us. "Never mind," I said, climbing up the ladder and peeking my head into the basement of Station 7, the power station. I'd never been inside any of the city stations, of course. They were like bunkers with high steel walls and fences surrounding them. Steelheart liked to keep things under a watchful eye. A place like this wouldn't just be a power station, but would have government offices on the upper floors as well. All carefully fenced, guarded, and observed. The basement, fortunately, had no cameras watching it. Most of those were in the hallways. Megan handed me my rifle, and I climbed out into the room above. We were in a storage chamber, dark save for a few of those glowing, always-on lights that places tend to, well, always leave on. I moved to the wall and tapped my mobile. "We're in," I said softly.
"Good,"
Cody's voice came back. I blushed. "Sorry, I meant to send that to Prof."
"You did. He told me to watch over y'all. Turn on the video feed from your earpiece."
The earpiece was one of those wraparound kinds and had a little camera sticking out over my ear. I tapped a few times on my mobile screen, activating it.
"Nice," Cody said. "Tia and I have set up here at Prof's entrance point."
Prof liked contingencies, and that usually meant leaving a person or two back to create diversions or enact plans if the main teams got pinned down.
"I don't have much to do here," Cody continued,
his southern drawl as thick as ever.
"So I'm going to bother you."
"Thanks," I said, glancing back at Megan as she climbed up out of the hole.
"Don't mention it, lad, and stop looking down Megan's shirt."
"I'm not."
"Just teasing. I hope you keep doing it. It'll be fun to watch her shoot you in the foot when she catches you."
I looked away pointedly.
Fortunately, it didn't appear that Cody had included Megan in that particular conversation. I actually found myself breathing a little easier, knowing that